program to monitor it every 10 minutes. The moment there's a fresh scan of this California plate number, he repeated it from memory, let me know at once.
Consider it done. You heard what happened last Friday at the warehouse where she wasted Larkin?
Ackerman asked.
She skipped before you got there. That's the thumbnail. The bitch left a firebomb on a timer, tried to torch us, the place crawling with crazed rats.
Yes, I heard that too.
Ackerman says, I ever get my hands on her, I'll feed her a rat and then set her on fire, I swear to hell.
No one would object, Hendrickson assures him. He terminates the call and speaks impatiently to Stacia Odell. No, everything off, everything, completely naked. Even though she is accessed, her embarrassment is evident, but she obeys. Hendrickson is somewhat surprised by his actions here. He has disdain for women who are not of his station, and his affairs tend to be with those one step above him on the social ladder. Even before being injected with a command mechanism, Stacia ranked below him in any class system worthy of observance, a middle-class striver lacking the intelligence and taste to rise above her beginnings. Now that she is one of the adjusted people, she is of the lowest caste, one step above a mere animal, and at least one step below an ordinary slave. He ought to feel unclean as he remains seated and directs her to kneel before him, as she leans in to service him, as she does what he commands. But this has been a day of frustration, and he is too tense to make the return trip to D.C. without this release. To him, Stacia is a primitive, almost another species, and this act is the closest thing to a transgression that he has the capacity to imagine. This is different from the girls of Aspasia, who are exquisitely designed and groomed fantasies, with no remembered past and no future. In their biographical and intellectual stasis, they fit nowhere in the class structure. They are so delicately unreal in their perfection and in their submissiveness that they might as well have stepped out of a wet dream. But Stacia has a past and a future, if one with severe limits, and when she's not being actively controlled, she thinks and feels. He can command her, as he can any Aspasia girl, but not with the certainty that absolute submission will always be given. Although unlikely, there is always the remote possibility that a primitive like Stacia could bite, which thrills Hendrickson. Chapter 19. In the two king-size beds, the four boys lay as oblivious to the world as if this were the first sleep of their lives, as if thousands of nights of unpaid slumber must now be accounted and rectified before morning. Luther was drawn toward the rollaway as though it was the most appealing bed he'd ever encountered. He would already have been deep in sleep if he hadn't needed to call Rebecca at 9 o'clock. He went into the bathroom so as not to disturb the children. He closed the lid of the toilet and sat down. With his disposable phone, he called her disposable, and soon learned that Rob Stassen's Buick had gotten them to Rockford, but not with the anonymity they wanted. An hour and a half earlier, they checked into an older hotel, a few blocks from where they abandoned the station wagon. Alarmed that they had been followed, but proud of the initiative with which they had shaken off their surveillance, Luther said, "How will you get to Chicago in time tomorrow?" Rebecca said, "I don't like the bus terminal or train station."
"I don't like them either."
"I fibbed to Robbie Stassen and said I was going to Madison to move Aunt Tandy in with Mom, so I thought. I didn't want to call Mom for help, that might be too obvious. But whoever these people are, they can't have every phone tapped, can they? So I called Aunt Tandy. Is that okay?"
"I think so. You had to do something."
"I told her Jolie and I are in Rockford. My Toyota went kaput. Could she loan me a car? She has two. Never sold Uncle Calvin's."
just across the border in Wisconsin, Madison was no more than 60 miles from Rockford.
Luther said, "You didn't tell her why you're in Rockford?"
I made up a story. Turns out Aunt Tandy has a boyfriend.
What is she, 80?
A young 79. The boyfriend is 70. She's a cradle robber. She's driving Calvin's Dodge. The boyfriend's following in her car so he can take her home. They'll be here in half an hour.
Luther said, "You're amazing how you're handling all this."
You should realize being married to a wild man like you has given me nerves of steel.
He smiled. I am a tough case to handle.
You'll never know how tough, sugar. So, Chicago tomorrow, and then what? Where do we go from there? Where are you?
On the move. I'll know by tomorrow night where I'll be next.
I need to see you, Luther.
Me too. More than anything. I love you. Remember that place we went that time on holiday, where most likely Twyla was conceived?
It's unforgettable.
Go there tomorrow. You've got my number. I've got yours. But if anything goes wrong, I'll know where to find you. How's Jolie?
She's a natural-born fugitive. No posse is ever going to track her down. She wants to talk to you. Daddy? Jolie said when she took the phone.
Hi, Candy Girl.
You haven't called me that in forever.
No offense meant.
None taken. Daddy, tell me straight. Is it all falling apart?
Is what falling apart, sweetheart?
The country, the world, civilization, the human experiment?
Everything's always falling apart, Jolie. But at the same time, it's always being rebuilt.
Excuse me, but that is a load of cow pies. You're better than that, Daddy.
You're right. Listen, it's not all falling apart. There's an evil thing going on, and like all evil things, it's going to end badly for the people behind it.
Are we going to be okay? You and Mom and me and Twyla? The girl was too smart to be reassured by platitudes.
All I can say, Jolie, is I'll do everything I can to be sure we're okay.
Good. Okay. That's all I wanted to hear. I love you, Daddy.
I love you too, Jolie.
After the call ended, even as tired as he was, Luther did not go at once to bed. He stood at the sink, gazing at his reflection, but not seeing himself, seeing instead Rebecca and Twyla and Jolie, their faces risen vividly in memory as if actually materializing in the mirror, conjured there by the intensity of his love. He said the briefest prayer that heaven's protection would be granted to these three precious women, for he was not confident that doing everything he could do for them would be enough. Chapter 20. Three $100 bills are sufficient to persuade the bellman to bring Hassan Zaghari and Kernan Beadle to the room next door to the one in which Rebecca and Jolie Tillman are ensconced for the night. They show him their Homeland Security ID simultaneous with offering the cash, but he seems to believe the identification only to the extent that it gives him an excuse to accept the money. His name is Jerry Hare, which quite appropriately rhymes with derriere, because the guy is a pain in that precise portion of the anatomy. To Hassan, Jerry Hare sounds like a cartoon character, and in fact, he kind of looks like one. Slightly buck teeth, a twitchy nose like a rabbit's, whites of the eye that are mostly pink, and ears just about large enough to be used to pull him out of a top hat if he would fit in one. Nervous, beyond reason, he returns 15 minutes after leaving them to their business, then again 15 minutes after that, each time to insist that he didn't know they would be staying more than 5 minutes and to impress on them that it isn't worth losing his job for $300, whereupon he extorts 100 more each time. He pretends that the front desk is likely to rent out this room at any moment, that another bellman might arrive with guests and their luggage.
But of course, a room in this two-star relic that is not rented by this hour of a Wednesday night will go unoccupied. His only saving grace is that he whispers and directs all of his complaints to Beadle, who remains at a suitable distance from Hassan. During all this rabbity angst, Hassan silently takes down a reproduction of Van Gogh's The Starry Night in a faux wood, faux gilded Baroque frame totally wrong for the art, which hangs from two hooks on the wall between this room and the next. He gingerly removes one of the hooks and a large nail from which it is suspended. As quietly as possible, he inserts a long, slender spike mic into the nail hole and presses it deeper, deeper, until he feels the tip make contact with the inside of the wall of the adjacent hotel room. He puts the attached earpiece in his right ear and switches on the super high-gain direct-coupled amplifier, which can provide a sound gain of up to 100,000 times the power of received vibrations. When the bellman makes a third visit, he wants another 300. Hassan turns off the amplifier long enough to whisper to Beadle for the bellman's benefit.
If this piece of shit won't settle for one last 100 and shut up and wait, then kill him.
Producing the 100, Beadle says to Jerry Hare,
You know, Uncle Sam is trillions in debt, Jerry. He doesn't have bottomless pockets anymore.
If the bellman doesn't believe the Homeland Security ID, he now takes seriously the death threat. As pale as Alice's rabbit and just as nervous, he stands very still, with his hands folded in front of him in what might be a posture of prayer, his eyes wide, nibbling at his lower lip with his protruding upper teeth. And so it is that Hassan is able to listen first to Rebecca and then Jolie as they speak with Luther Tillman. He can hear only one side of the telephone conversation, but he gets plenty of useful information from what the women say to the sheriff and what they say to each other after the call is concluded. Minutes later, from a corner of the ground floor lobby, Hassan calls Huey Darnell in Minnesota to report their progress and receive instructions. Huey is curiously reluctant to provide guidance.
What do I know? Any direction on this should come from Hendrickson. Call him and see what he wants.
Me? Call him? Hassan says.
I don't have his number.
Why not?
He gives it out on a need-to-know basis, doesn't he?
Well, now you need to know,
Huey says.
You have a pen and paper?
No, but I've got a memory. Go ahead.
After he has the number, Hassan says,
You think I can call him now, this late?
You can wait till Christmas if you think that's best, but my opinion, which isn't worth very damn much, is call him now.
After a hesitation, Hassan says,
Are you all right, Huey?
I'm swell, Hassan. I'm peachy keen. I'm the tops. I'm the Tower of Pisa. I'm the tops. I'm the Mona Lisa.
Hassan is silent for a moment. Then,
Well, okay. I'll call him now.
Chapter 21. Many thousands of feet above the earth, where the atmosphere is too thin to sustain life, where a sky of clouds lies below and a sky of cold stars arcs above, where time in its cruel and relentless progress seems to apply only to the masses quarreling across the planet's surface, in the cushioned comfort of the Gulfstream 5 jet, Booth Hendrickson enjoys a late dinner of capon served with style by a flight steward in the employ of the FBI, but for this journey, on loan to the Department of Justice. There is a superb side order of haricot vert and another of pasta alfredo. The white wine is properly chilled and crisp and so delicious that Hendrickson doesn't ask the name of it, for fear that it will prove to be of an undistinguished label and therefore will disturb his sense of the proper order of things. A flight from Louisville to Washington is not usually long enough for one to enjoy a leisurely dinner with dessert, followed by a carefully nurtured serving of 40-year-old port. However,
While choppering to Louisville from Iron Furnace, Hendrickson arranged for the pilot to file a new flight plan that set a course to Washington by way of Atlanta, Georgia. If this unconventional route, filed so late, presents air traffic control problems, civilian air corridors can be cleared of commercial flights in order to accommodate an official engaged on urgent business for his nation. Between the entree and the lemon tart with basil ice cream, as Hendrickson is enjoying the last of his wine, a call comes through from one Hassan Zaghari, whom he knows, but who should not have his most private cell number. Huey Darnell, again. Hassan succinctly explains the situation with Rebecca and Jolie Tillman, and gives a concise account of the phone call placed to them by the Podunk sheriff. Then, "The aunt's car will be in the hotel garage before long, sir. Beadle and I can tag a locator on it and follow them into Chicago as well as wherever they go from there." "That won't be necessary. You've told me all I need to know, which is where they're headed in Chicago. From there, I'll have a lock on them."
"Whatever you say, sir."
"You've done excellent work, Hassan."
"Thank you, sir."
"I do have one more task for you after your long day, if you feel up to it."
"I'm always game, sir."
"I am familiar with your service record. You don't hesitate to remove the enemies of progress with prejudice when necessary."
"When it's necessary," Hassan says. "That's the last situation in which you want to hesitate."
"Beadle can drive back to Minnesota, but for you I'll have a prop jet at the airport in Rockford to fly you till Milwaukee. An SUV will be waiting there. Drive flat out. You should get to Tillman's house by 1 in the morning. Huey Darnell will be halfway through the job he's doing, if he's not only a quarter of the way."
"What job is that, sir?"
"Going through the house with a fine-tooth comb, looking for anything that ties Tillman to Jane Hawk. When you get there, tell Darnell I've sent you to assist him."
"Yes, sir."
"Hassan, what is your opinion of Mr. Darnell? Don't give me a candy-coated version. I know you to be a capable and discerning man. I only want the unvarnished truth."
"He drinks too much," Hassan says.
"To the point, as usual. Now, once you're in Tillman's house, you will find a gun safe in his study. I have seen it myself. You will need to open the gun safe and take an appropriate handgun from it and remove from my side the thorn that is Huey Darnell. It would be best if you shot him in the back of the head, twice, execution style. The story will be that Sheriff Tillman, now in league with Jane Hawk, killed one of Homeland Security's finest men."
"Is the sheriff anywhere in that vicinity, sir?"
"It doesn't matter, Hassan. When necessary, there will be ample evidence found to prove his presence during the crime. But first, I really do need to know if there's anything in the house linking him to Hawk."
"If there is, I'll find it, sir."
"I know that you will, Hassan." Too discreet to approach while Hendrickson was on the phone, the steward now arrives with dessert and coffee. "Has everything been to your liking so far, sir?"
"Marvelous," Hendrickson assures him.
"Superb. Tell me, a little while ago, did I detect the plane banking east-northeast?"
"Yes, sir. At the moment, we're approximately over Columbia, South Carolina."
"In the event that port is served too close to Washington, I assume the pilot can arrange to delay landing."
"Absolutely," the steward says. "We can be put into the holding pattern for Reagan International if you wish. I'll let you know."
Alone now with his dessert and coffee, Hendrickson is amused to recall how disquieted, even distressed, he had been in the security bunker at the resort when he discovered that the ubiquitous Jane Hawk had been in Iron Furnace. For a brief time, it seemed that she must be the embodiment of some preternatural power manifested here in the flesh to enforce some natural law at the expense of all things Arcadian, an avatar against whom no wiles or weapons could prevail. But now she has been tracked to Arkansas without her knowledge. Another automatic license plate reading will come in soon, and he will be that much closer to knowing her destination. She is clever. However, no one is ever gifted enough to elude the many eyes of the modern state for long. She has made another big mistake in aligning herself with Sheriff Tillman. Jane is best alone, a she-wolf who knows how to travel by moonshadows even in daylight, a solitary predator who will be brought down much sooner due to the mistakes made by any pack she runs with than she would be by her own errors. Hendrickson now has a leash on the Tillman women, though they aren't aware of it, and when they reunite with the sheriff, Hendrickson will have him as well. When he has the sheriff, he will soon thereafter have Jane Hawk. The disquiet he felt earlier was a transient emotion, evoked because he briefly lost his grasp on the undeniable truth that he and the Arcadians are not only on the right side of history, but can rewrite all history before them. They will eliminate from the record of the past all of those facts and philosophies that they find inconvenient. As for the future, which is the history of things to come, they will write that as well, every day until forever. Now that he is again in possession of this truth, he is incapable of entertaining any misgivings. As medicines go, there is no curing combination more effective than an orgasm, a fine dinner, a superb wine, and the possession of a sleek jet aircraft with the world attendant below and firmly in the grasp of night. Chapter 22. At 4:20 a.m. Thursday, after 9 hours of restful sleep, Jane sat up on the rollaway and swung her legs out of bed, as instantly and fully awake as if roused by a gunshot. Incorporated in the last of her dreams had been a recognition of something that she had overlooked in that Kentucky village. Horrified by the condition into which the people of that town had fallen, in her vehement determination to extract the children from imprisonment, she had not considered that her usual precautions might not be sufficient to the strange circumstances of Iron Furnace. She had instructed one keeper of the children to destroy all the security video at the fake school. But what if the town itself was fitted out with more than a few traffic cams? Given the importance of its function as a conversion center, and considering that the Arcadians must be studying this experiment in total control in order to refine it for future application, Iron Furnace might be surveilled down to the square foot around the clock. If cameras were everywhere, she hadn't noticed an excess, but these days cameras of the highest quality were so small and could be so cunningly integrated into any setting that she might not have been aware of them. She had parked the Ford Escape on a quiet residential street where no camera should have caught her going to or from it. But what if they had identified her wheels? License plate scanning was a rapidly growing automatic function of many police vehicles. She could travel anonymously only as long as they didn't have a vehicle description and plate number. Having slept in jeans and sweater, she put on her shoes, her rig with pistol, and her sport coat. While the four girls remained deep in sleep, she let herself out of the room, onto the awning-covered, dimly lighted promenade, and closed the door behind her. The Oklahoma night was chilly, clear, and quiet. She studied the parking lot, which was darker than she would have liked, the shadowed shapes of vehicles like a line of immense porcine creatures feeding at a trough. In the street, a delivery truck bearing a dairy's name and logo passed slowly. Suspiciously slow? In an age when nothing was what it seemed, even a milk truck warranted sharp attention. She watched it out of sight and listened in expectation that its engine noise would stop receding and grow louder as it returned. But then the sound of it diminished beyond hearing. Nothing on the farther side of the street strummed any chord of danger from the harp strings of her intuition, and she was willing to believe that the children were safe. She went to her nearby Ford and retrieved tools from under the front passenger seat. Screwdriver, Phillips head screwdriver, pliers, adjustable wrench. Each instrument in a separate pocket in a folding chamois kit. A hammer was wrapped separately. Working quickly and quietly, hoping to avoid drawing attention, she unscrewed the front and back plates from the Ford. She put them in the car. Without the plates, she would be at risk of drawing a patrolman's attention. But as soon as they were out of Ardmore, they would exit I-35 and find a place where they were unobserved. She'd work on the front plate with pliers and hammer to make it appear as if it had been crankled in some minor mishap, though her purpose would be to distort it so that any flat-reading scanner would be foiled. They could mix up some mud with which to splatter the back of the Ford, with emphasis on the rear plate. This deception might keep them safe until Sackett Ranch, but any lawman who by chance got a look at both the front and back plates would know the scam when he saw it. The girls were still sleeping when Jane returned to the room. She took advantage of the moment to lay out a change of clothes and be first in the bathroom. She showered quickly, for she was unable to hear anything other than the drumming of water on the walls and floor of the stall, so that her imagination alternately scripted the kidnapping of the children and then a sudden bloody assault on them. Chapter 23. Late Thursday morning in Chicago, at O'Hare International, Rebecca was waiting with Jolie at the baggage carousel when Twyla appeared among the in-streaming travelers. Tall and slim, wearing a sapphire blue dress with pin tucks at the shoulders and a lightly ruffled placket, carrying a coat over one arm, she looked less like a 19-year-old college student than like a famous model of perhaps 25, radiating experience and sophistication. Her smile, when it came as she noticed them, made her yet lovelier. Gladdened by the sight of her older daughter and wanting to believe they would together navigate the current storm, Rebecca nevertheless scrutinized the people who followed in Twyla's wake, alert for someone who seemed unduly interested in her. But she was not trained in crowd analytics, and in such situations as this, either everyone appeared suspicious or no one did. Twyla hugged her mother, kissed her. "I've really missed you." But it was to Jolie that Twyla gave herself entirely. The two embraced, fell into excited conversation and laughter, commenting on each other's hair and clothes, often with the affectionate sarcasm in which they had engaged since adolescence. Rebecca had forgotten how much alike the sisters were, not quite twins in appearance, each with her unique style, but alike in their enthusiasm and intelligence. With only the 2-year difference in ages, they had always been as close as twins. Twyla's passion was art, her talent so strong that she was on a 2/3 scholarship through her sophomore year with a prospect of receiving full tuition thereafter, while Jolie lived for literature. One arm around Jolie, Twyla turned to her mother. "You said, drop everything. Come now. Nobody's dying, but it's important. Such mystery. Such drama. I'm crazy to know. Tell me." "Not here, sweetie. Let's get on the road first. Does this have something to do with Ms. Gunderson? That insane horribleness at the hotel? When Daddy called last week about that, he wasn't like himself at all. He was having the vapors, going on about Boston being half a world away, which it isn't. It's not even an eighth of a world away. Mother, I simply can't go to school in Milwaukee or, God forbid, St. Cloud, if only because that's not where I have a scholarship. First things first. Which is your suitcase, dear?" Twyla had arrived with one large bag exactly like Jolie's. Their parents had given both girls the same 3-piece suit of luggage a few years earlier. After they snared the suitcase from the carousel, they were soon in Aunt Tandy's Dodge, where Jolie ceded the shotgun position to Twyla and settled in the back seat. Leaving the short-term parking lot, Rebecca remained wary, frequently consulting the rearview mirror. But if she were being tailed, Those following her would have to be numerous and operating in a fleet, for the vehicles behind her kept changing. Of course, if the car was electronically tagged, their pursuers wouldn't have to maintain visual contact. Yes, but it wasn't likely that Aunt Tandy's phone was tapped, that anyone knew she'd brought a car to Rockford the previous night. Rebecca and Jolie would have been on the road from Rockford before the men watching the station wagon at the motor inn realized that the Buick had been abandoned. And when she had summoned Twyla to Chicago rather than Milwaukee, she had used her disposable cell and had taken steps to ensure that anyone who might be monitoring the girl's phone or even running eyes-on surveillance would be thwarted. Yet, the rearview mirror compelled her attention, and she knew that Twyla was aware of that. When they unsnarled themselves from the airport tangle and were headed east on Interstate 90, Twyla said, "Home's not this way. Why are we going into the city?" "We're not," Rebecca said. "Only as far as I-94, then north."
"To where?"
"To a place filled with good memories for your father and me. You'll see."
"Is Daddy waiting there?"
"No, dear. He'll call us later and let us know the next step."
"The next step? Where is he now?"
"He didn't say. Maybe he will later." Twyla leaned left to glance past the headrest at her sister in the back seat.
"I know it isn't possible that our parents have been deep cover spies all our lives and are now on the run. That's a TV show, and life isn't a TV show. You know what this is about?"
"What I know," Jolie said, "is that we're in deep doo-doo. But I'm not clear whose doo-doo it is or why we've got to wade through it. And neither is Mother. Daddy is playing this one close to the vest."
"I've never seen Daddy wear a vest. He sometimes wears a Kevlar one."
Chapter 24. With no pale shore in sight, the great green sea shimmered in the afternoon sun. Grass for water, tides influenced not by the moon, but by the soft breeze. Slender, buoyant harriers circled overhead, fishing for mice in the waves of grass. The vast, timeless landscape and the quiet that lay on it gave Jane a sense of peace, though the mice probably did not share her mood. After Leland and Nadine Sackett had bought the 600-acre Dude Ranch, they rebuilt and expanded it into the first-class Sackett home and school, where now 139 children resided. Of the opinion that children without parents deserved to grow up in a magical place to compensate for their loss, the Sacketts kept the western theme of the structures. The school resembled an idealized prairie town circa 1880. There were ponies and horses so that every child might learn from riding instructors and be not only well-educated, but also well-seasoned by the land and its traditions. To prevent staff members from recognizing Jane, the Sacketts drove one of the school's buses to meet her and Luther at the ranch entrance, a mile from its buildings. A day earlier, Chase Longren outlined for them the terms under which they needed to take these 8. The kids must not initially be included in school records and must be protected from discovery by visiting social workers. The 8 were coached to tell other children that they were moving from an orphanage closing in Oklahoma. The truth of their past could not be revealed, even to the Sacketts, until an indefinite future date. Leland and Nadine's doubts were outweighed by their conviction that every child in need was sent to them by the spirit of the son they had lost to meningitis when he was 3. Harley Higgins and the other children of Iron Furnace had been with Jane and Luther less than 2 full days, but they were loath to be separated from them. She knelt to smooth their hair, kiss them, and tell them that Luther would either remain with them or soon return when he settled some business of his. She, too, would come back one day. Meanwhile, the good people of this special place would never become strangers to them, as had their own parents. She hoped these promises wouldn't prove false. As Jane finished with the children, Luther led them to the bus, assuring them that he was their sheriff, always looking after them. Harley hurried back to her and took her hand and squeezed it hard. He tried to say something and could not. She kissed his brow and held him close and said, I know, sweetheart, and took him by the hand to the bus. Chapter 25. In part because of the potential fire hazard, the hay barn, a long corrugated metal building insulated against summer heat, stood at the end of an oiled secondary lane. On the ranch, but more than a quarter of a mile from Sackett home. At the end of harvest, a couple thousand bales would have been stored there, though the supply would now be half that. In the Chrysler Voyager, Luther followed her forward to the hay barn, where they parked along the east wall in afternoon shadows. Two saddled horses were tied up to a railing there. They didn't spook at the cars, but regarded Jane and Luther with curiosity and nickered in greeting. Luther, I'd like a little time alone with my in-laws.
Of course. Take as long as you need.
Inside, bales were stacked high all around, the air redolent of hay, heatless LED lamps pouring down a hard, almost blue light, like a radiance in a dream of revelation, in which bits of dry chaff and dust motes floated in miniature galaxies. Nick's parents were waiting. Ansel, the father that Jane's real father had not the clarity of soul to be, and Claire, the mother that Jane's real mother would have been if she had not been murdered. She hadn't seen them since Nick's funeral. A flood of emotion surprised her. Love, profound thankfulness that this good and strong-hearted pair were in her life, grief over the loss they shared, a piercing loneliness that rose from the knowledge that she would shortly be deprived of them again, and fear. When they spoke and started toward her, she held up a hand to ask for a moment. She turned half away from them and got control of herself and fought back the tears and told herself that what she dreaded would not here come to pass, that her paranoia had for the moment gotten the better of her. Turning to them again, she said, "Play Manchurian with me."
"Play what?" Claire asked.
And neither of them said, "All right." Chapter 26. Luther waited with the horses for 15 minutes. When Jane opened the door and asked him into the hay barn, he saw that they had all been in tears, even the rancher, who looked as though he was carved from Texas oak and harder than bedrock. Their regard for their daughter-in-law was so high that any friend of hers was a brother to them. Claire kissed Luther on the cheek, and Ansel used both hands to shake one of the sheriffs. They expressed such gratitude for what Luther had done that it seemed as though Jane must have told them that she'd had the smallest part in rescuing the children, and that he had carried them and her out of Kentucky on his back. If Ansel and Claire ever talked about themselves, Luther had no evidence of it that afternoon, as they seemed interested only in his wife and two daughters, what the Tillman women were like, where they were now, how he proposed to bring them to safety. Going into the barn, he'd had only a vague idea of how he might bring his family together again in this world gone so dark in but a week. However, Leland and Nadine Sackett delivered an early picnic dinner and set it out on a red-and-white checkered oilcloth atop hay bales that served as a table, and by the time they reached dessert, the six of them had arrived at a plan. Chapter 27. The sky was decanting its last 90 minutes of light when Ansel and Claire rode out of Sackett Ranch, overland toward home, where they would not arrive until well after dark. The day was mild, but either the planes began to give up what little heat they had stored, or some unknowable observer behind the apparent reality of land and light saw fit to color the moment mystic, because as they receded, a watery blue corona formed around them, into which they passed, as if not only into the distance, but also outside of time. When Jane was moved to turn from the sight of her in-laws receding, Luther turned away as well.
So, I guess, San Diego.
It's a nice city. Go Padres.
Otis Faucher's builder son?
Name's Wilson Faucher. I need to know about building codes.
But in San Francisco?
Otis said Wilson's done some things there, too.
If you could wait a few days, then I could help you.
Can't wait. Or won't. Anyway, it's best you bring your family safely here while you still can.
Once I do that, you'll know how to find me.
She looked at him and smiled and clapped him on the back. If they decide to make you number two on America's Most Wanted list, you won't be able to go out and about. Big and black as you are, you can't just put on a blonde wig, some makeup, and pass unnoticed.
Shave my head, grow a beard, go a little gangsta with my wardrobe.
Get your family, Luther. Maybe bald, bearded, and badass will be almost enough of a makeover if I need to call you down the road. She felt something crawling on her left hand and raised it from her side and saw a dewdrop-sized ladybug born into the world too soon in the season, bearing its black-spotted orange shell from knuckle to knuckle. Luther said,
"So, DJ Michael's apartment is on the 9th floor?
He financed the building. He owns it. He has the entire 9th floor to himself. 4 apartments worth of space folded into one. And the way I've been told, the 8th and 10th floors are part of his security system.
Way up in the middle of the air. How do you get there?
One way or the other." The ladybug reached the base knuckle of her index finger and continued its exploration around the side of her hand, through the perlicue between thumb and finger. She turned her palm up to follow the bug's progress.
"What do you think you can get from him?" Luther asked.
"A video confession. The names of his co-conspirators."
"Tall order. He has that crazy big vision thing going on. King of the world now, but going to make himself god of all."
"I don't expect him to be easy."
"It'll take time to break down a man like that, so sure of himself. Even if you get to him, you won't have a lot of time."
"I'll have enough." The ladybug paused in the anatomical snuffbox of Jane's hand, as though surveying the way ahead and considering the possibilities of her palm. After a silence, Luther said,
"You're scaring me a little now."
"I doubt that."
"I mean, scared for you. You have what it takes, but you also need some luck. You've had a long run of luck in this, but nobody's luck holds forever."
The ladybug started to follow Jane's heart line, but then turned into the lifeline, making its way toward her wrist.
"Suppose you get to the 9th floor and then everything goes wrong."
Abruptly, the ladybug took wing, and watching it, Jane said, "Then I'll fly." Chapter 28. Under the circumstance, Jolie Tillman had not been expecting Thursday to be one of the premier days of her life, but when it turned very bad indeed, it did so in a way she could never have predicted. Before checking into the hotel, their mother took them on a cruise through a couple Lake Forest residential neighborhoods of elegant mansions and massive old oak trees. She waxed on about the long walks that she and Daddy had taken on a faraway summer when the light was crystalline and the shadows velvet, when through the air soared dazzling phoenixes that burst into flame but were born anew in flight, when there were unicorns gambling on lawns, and when at night the falling stars proved to be sprays of diamonds that you could scoop up from the street by the fistful. Or at least that's how it sounded to Jolie, the tenor of the narrative, if not its specifics. Considering that a sinister man with a snake tattoo and his no doubt creepier companion had followed them to Rockford, that they were puttering around in Aunt Tandy's Dodge, which still smelled of Uncle Calvin's verbena cologne 3 years after his death, that Daddy had crossed swords with psychotic criminals who were somehow connected to the fiery deaths of 46 people at the Veblen Hotel, and that the whole family was on the run from said criminals, Mother's nostalgic recollections seemed not only inappropriate, but downright weird. From all this, Jolie made three assumptions. First, that her mother and father had been deeply in love from the start, and wildly, totally hot for each other when they spent a week in Lake Forest back in the day. Second, that the hole in which the family now found itself was deeper and darker than Mother had yet let on. Third, that though her mother was brilliant when dealing with crises, this one pressed her toward the limit of her ability to cope, so she took refuge in nostalgia to remind herself that if there had been better days in the past, there might be better days in the future. By design, explained Mom, the tour guide, Lake Forest, Illinois had few access points from surrounding communities. This was a realm of quiet wealth, beautiful mansions on multi-acre estates, community forests maintained with admirable care, and polo in the summer. The only hotel in all of Lake Forest was the Deer Path Inn, where Mother and Daddy stayed in that magical week when the formations of flying doves formed the word love in the sky and water turned to wine as you raised the glass to your lips. Built in 1929, the inn offered lovely public rooms and supposedly the most delicious food. The rooms were somewhat cramped and dated, Mother said, and too expensive for their limited budget of on-the-run cash. However, it was off-season, and rooms were available, and the hotel staff was superb, even legendary. And Daddy expected them to be there. At 4:30 p.m., a bellman escorted them to two adjoining rooms, one for Jolie and Twyla, one for Mother. Daddy was going to call at 5 o'clock, after which they would go to dinner and pretend that all of them were as carefree as Mary Poppins. Even though the connecting door between rooms was closed, Twyla pulled Jolie into their little bathroom and closed that door before she said, "What the hell is going on? She doesn't call me. She calls Sherry, my roommate. We talk on Sherry's phone about how I'm to come to Chicago first thing tomorrow, which is now today, and I'm to use Sherry's phone to make the reservation? Oh, and be sure I'm not followed to the airport in Boston. What is all this hugger-mugger?" "Wow, Twy, that's a fabulous word for someone who's far more oriented to images than to language. College is opening your horizons. Don't jerk my chain, Joe. Tell me what you know. Are you too sophisticated now? Jerking each other's chains is such fun." Jolie was sincere. Her sister was better with visuals than with words, but she could give as well as she got. "Twy, it's a key part of our relationship." Twyla looked grim. "Tell me what you know." "Okay, okay. But I don't know that much more than you. Only what happened yesterday in Rockford. Mother is..." The ringtone of Twyla's smartphone was muffled inside her handbag, which stood on the counter beside the sink. Jolie said, "Mom wouldn't want you to answer that. We're only using disposables." Withdrawing the phone from the bag, checking caller ID, Twyla said, "Gotta take this. It's a guy." "You've got a boyfriend? You never said!" "Scoot, go, get out," Twyla ordered, opening the door to push her sister into the bedroom. She closed the door between them. Jolie heard her say, "Hello?" A silence. "All right," Another silence. We're in Lake Forest, this place called the Deer Path Inn. Then Twyla must have turned her back to the door and lowered her voice. Jolie could understand only a word here and there. It wasn't a long call, and when Twyla opened the bathroom door, Jolie said,
"Why'd you tell him where we are?"
"You were eavesdropping."
"I couldn't help but hear when we're like 2 feet apart." "Why'd you tell him where we are?"
"Why ever wouldn't I?"
"Mom told you not to tell anyone."
"Oh, Jolie, dear. You don't understand."
"What don't I understand?"
Pulling her into the bathroom once more, closing the door, Twyla said, "You don't understand how it is between men and women."
"Well, Miss Hot Lips, I've had boyfriends," Jolie reminded her.
"That's high school, Jolie. It's a lot different when you get out in the world."
"How's it different?"
"You'll see one day." Twyla turned to the mirror.
"God, I've got vampire eyes. I need some drops."
"What's his name?" Jolie asked. Extracting a bottle of Visine from her bag, Twyla said,
"Who?"
"The stud. The guy.
The boyfriend."
Twyla squeezed Visine into one eye, blinking rapidly. She seemed to be taking time to think. Then she said,
"Charles."
"Charles what?"
"You'll just tell Mother."
"I'm not ready to tell her yet. I shouldn't have told you, even Charles." As Twyla dripped Visine into her other eye, Jolie said,
"Oh, shit. You're hiding his last name because he's married."
"He's not married."
"You're dating a married man."
"I am not."
"Oh, shit. You're pregnant."
Putting away the Visine, regarding her sister's reflection in the mirror rather than turning to her, Twyla said,
"You are such a child, Joe. Everything's a melodrama with you. I'm not pregnant. He's not married."
She switched on the bathroom fan. "Daddy's going to be calling Mother in a few minutes. Then we'll be off to dinner." She opened the door.
"You want to freshen up first, or should I?"
"I don't need to freshen up. I'm already as fresh as it gets." Gently pressing her sister backward across the threshold, Twyla said,
"So give me some privacy, please. And I haven't forgotten that you dodged telling me what you know about this. I want a full report later."
Once more, she closed the door between them. Something was wrong. All that stuff about being as fresh as it gets, that was a setup. Teeing the ball so that Twy could come back with something funny, one of the hard shots that were her trademark. She would never miss such an opportunity. Not the old Twyla. Not the pre-guy Twyla. She was dating a married man. She was pregnant. And she was dying of cancer. Something like that. Worried, still smarting from the "you are such a child" comment, Jolie picked up her suitcase and put it on the bed and opened it to get a cashmere scarf to wear against the evening cold. She stood in confusion for a moment, looking at clothes that weren't hers, and at a flat, clear plastic snap-latch case held in place by the suitcase's stretchy cross straps. Even as she realized that she had opened her sister's bag by mistake, it being identical to hers, the contents of the soft plastic case registered with her. 4 hypodermic syringes. Jolie felt as though some ghost in the room had reached its cool ectoplasmic hand into her body to clutch her heart. In disbelief, she touched the case. It was real, not imagined, and cold to the touch. Why cold? She opened the clasp on the suitcase cross straps and picked up the case of syringes and saw a 7-inch square metal box, perhaps 5 inches in depth. The box felt colder than the syringes. The tightly fitted hinged lid was difficult to open even after Jolie released the little latch. The box and lid were lined with a 1/2 inch of dense insulation, so that the interior dimensions were maybe 6 by 6 by 4, and upon exposure to the air, a cold vapor rose from a perforated plastic packet that filled the bottom half of the container.
Dry ice?
She murmured. Nestled on the packet were 9 sleeves of silvery insulation, each about the size of a finger. She picked up one of them, and it was so cold it almost burned her fingers. The sleeve had a tiny Velcro closure at one end. She opened it, and into her palm slid a sealed glass ampoule containing a cloudy amber fluid. In the bathroom, the toilet flushed. Jolie returned the ampoule to the sleeve of insulation, put the sleeve in the box, closed the lid, and engaged the latch. Water running in the sink, Twyla washing her hands. Jolie tucked the box in the suitcase, put the syringes atop it, and engaged the cross straps. She closed the suitcase, stood it on the floor, put her own suitcase on the bed, and opened it. Whether the surnameless Charles was married or not, whether or not he had gotten Twyla pregnant, she was doing drugs. Not anything as small-time as marijuana, which would have been plenty bad enough. Drugs that you mainlined, like heroin or something. Twyla had gone away to college and fallen in with the wrong crowd. Whoever Charles was, whether he was married or not, he was a bad influence who had gotten Twyla on drugs. Jolie was shaken, heartsick, and not sure what to do. The sound of running water no longer issued from the bathroom, but the door didn't open. Twyla could take forever adjusting makeup and redoing her lipstick. Jolie wondered if she ought to go into the next room and tell her mother what she'd found. No, she shouldn't act precipitously. In a lot of novels, young women got themselves in serious trouble by acting impetuously, out of ignorance or a misunderstanding. Jolie sat on the edge of the hotel bed, elbows on her thighs, face in her hands, trying to think what action she should take next. Usually, when Twyla was prepping herself to go out, she sang one song or another. She wasn't singing now. Something was so wrong. Everything was so wrong. Chapter 29. In the last half hour of light, the broad western sky gathered itself toward what promised to be a colorful sunset, facilitated by discreet, attenuated clouds. On Interstate 10, Jane Hawk drove 5 miles per hour under the speed limit, wanting nothing more than to avoid calling attention to herself, although she carried on her person everything required to get her through a confrontation. Many miles earlier, Nadine Sackett had given her a thermos of hot black coffee, for which she was grateful, and a bag of homemade sugar cookies, which she didn't intend to eat. The cookies gave off a pleasant aroma, however, as did the coffee, and the Ford Escape felt almost cozy, a little high-speed haven from a hostile world. She needed to get to Nogales, Arizona, to trade the car back to Enrique de Soto for another that would likewise be one thing on the exterior and a different beast altogether under the hood, that would have no GPS and a new set of plates. Another 14 or 15 hours of road separated her from Nogales. Allowing for a night's sleep, she didn't expect to be bargaining with Enrique before late Saturday morning. After dark, when she arrived in Sonora, she would boost the plates off a parked car, switch them to the Ford, and have greater peace of mind during the run to Nogales. When her luck changed, the sun was hanging swollen near the horizon, the red-veined orange of a bloody yolk, seeming to tremble as if it might burst when it settled to the low, fractured ridge rock of this sere landscape. The highway patrol car came out of the east in a faster lane than hers, with neither its siren nor its roof-mounted light bar engaged. If the trooper meant to pass her, he changed his mind, abruptly reduced speed, and swung in behind the Ford. She neither sped up nor slowed, and he paced her for a mile. Maybe the NCIC had been provided with a description of her car, after it was captured by a traffic cam in Iron Furnace. Or maybe the mud on the license plate intrigued him. Even if he couldn't read the plate, a lone woman in a black Ford Escape might be enough to remind him of America's most sought-after murderer and traitor,